Hello, I'm Marian Heatherly, Community Engagement Coordinator for the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. You're listening to special programming on the 2024 total solar eclipse. We wanted to start off with an article about the history of solar eclipses from Discover magazine. Eclipses have held sway over humanity since long before we knew what these events truly were. As humans have evolved on Earth, many naturally occurring events, earthquakes, volcanoes, destructive weather, have struck fear into their hearts. At the top of the list, though, may be the disappearance of the life-giving sun from the midday sky during a total solar eclipse. Even today, the drama of such phenomena compels people to travel halfway around the globe to witness them. But which eclipses throughout history are the most noteworthy? For this list, I've chosen to include eclipses you might not be familiar with, including many that happened before the invention of the telescope. As you read through them, particularly the earliest accounts, try to imagine standing in darkness beneath the moon's shadow for a few fleeting minutes, which, in the minds of those terrified souls, must have seemed much longer. Our first entry is the earliest solar eclipse for which we have a record. The account appears in the ancient Chinese text Shu Jing, traditionally said to have been compiled by the philosopher Confucius, which reads, "On the first day of the last month of autumn, the sun and moon did not meet harmoniously in Fang." What an understated way to describe an eclipse. Pinning the exact date of this event is somewhat problematic. Originally, scholars stated it occurred either in 2136 BCE or 2128 BCE. The mention of Fang, though, ultimately holds the key. This term refers to a section of the sky mainly in Scorpius. Furthermore, we know the eclipse happened during the reign of Zhong Kang, an emperor of the Zheng dynasty. Based on these details, the only eclipse that could have been seen from the capital city was October 22, 2137 BCE. There's also a long-standing tale, which may be true but probably isn't, about this eclipse and two royal astrologers, He and Ho. In at least one version, they were drunk prior to the event and didn't warn the emperor that the eclipse was coming. Whether or not they even knew it was coming is debatable. Long story short, they reportedly were killed for their mistake. Our next entry is recorded in the Shixing, a collection of ancient poetry, whose compilation is also credited to Confucius. The eclipse in question occurred during the Zhou dynasty, though the exact date is uncertain. Some astronomers have pointed to the total eclipse of June 4th, 781 BCE, though this would have only been a partial eclipse in Zhou territory. Another candidate is the eclipse of November 30th, 735 BCE, which was annular in the western Zhou capital of Hao, near modern-day Zhang. About the same time in Greece, Plutarch wrote about an annular eclipse that occurred around the death of Romulus in 716 BCE. Such an eclipse happened December 10th. The path of annularity crossed northern Africa, while in Athens, a bit more than one-third of the sun was obscured by the moon. More than a century later, a total solar eclipse on May 28, 585 BCE might have ended a war between the Lydians and the Medes. Greek historian Herodotus wrote about the conclusion of the conflict in Book 1 of his Histories. Quote, "As the balance had not inclined in favor of either nation, another engagement took place in the sixth year of the war, in the course of which, just as the battle was growing warm, day was suddenly turned into night. When the Lydians and Medes observed the change, they ceased fighting and were alike anxious to conclude peace." Close quote. A later solar eclipse had a similar effect when it cast a shadow on a conflict over Corinth between the Spartans, led by Cleombrotus, and the invading Persians, led by Xerxes I. Herodotus wrote that, quote, while Cleombrotus was offering sacrifice to know if he should march out against the Persians, the sun was suddenly darkened in mid-sky, close quote. As you might imagine, some 2,500 years ago, eclipses were not seen as good omens. This one, which astronomers now think occurred October 2nd, 480 BCE, rattled Cleombrotus and caused a full retreat of the Spartan forces. Nearly half a century later, a solar eclipse nearly stopped the army of Athens from attacking the Spartans. In his History of the Peloponnesian War, Greek historian Thucydides wrote, in the same summer, at the beginning of a new lunar month, at which time alone the phenomenon seemed possible, the sun was eclipsed after midday and became full again after it had assumed a crescent form and after some of the stars had shone out. This eclipse best matches one on August 3rd, 431 BCE. From northern Greece, the moon would have covered more than 91% of the sun. The stars that shone out were almost certainly Venus, which was 20 degrees from our daytime star, and Jupiter, which was twice as far away from the eclipsed sun. Shortly after BCE became CE, a record of notable solar eclipse comes to us from a work titled Contra Celsum by the theologian Origen of Alexandria. In it, he writes of an eclipse that occurred during the reign of Tiberius Julius Caesar Augustus. He states that there was, quote, the greatest eclipse of the sun, and also that it became the night in the sixth hour of the day, which would have been noon, so that stars even appeared in the heavens. There was a great earthquake in Bithynia, and many things were overturned in Nicaea. This event transpired November 24th in the year 29. Some theologians have speculated that this eclipse may have caused the darkness, as described in the Bible, during the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. However, the eclipse was not total from Jerusalem. In other words, not nearly dark enough to be described as darkness. Additionally, many Christian scholars suspect the crucifixion occurred later, likely in either the year 30 or 33, and that the reported darkness may have been caused by a massive dust storm rather than a solar eclipse. The eclipse on March 20th, 71, stands out because in a book titled De Face de Orbi Lunae, which means on the face which appears in the orb of the moon, the Greek philosopher Plutarch described the corona. This outer atmosphere of the sun had doubtless been seen during hundreds of total solar eclipses prior, but Plutarch was the first to write of it, saying, quote, even if the moon, however, does sometimes cover the sun entirely, the eclipse does not have duration or extension, but a kind of light is visible around the rim which keeps the shadow from being profound and absolute, close quote. After Plutarch's account, it would take another 266 years before someone described another solar feature seen during an eclipse. That happened when a member of the Roman Senate, Julius Firmicus Maternus, authored the earliest description of a prominence. His observation is even more remarkable because the July 17, 334 event was an annular eclipse, and he wasn't even on the path of annularity. He watched it from Sicily, where it was an 88% partial eclipse. July 19, 418 marks the first total solar eclipse, of which we have a record, during which a comet was seen. Turkish-born church historian Philostorgius wrote in Book 12 of the Epitome Historiae Ecclesiasticae, when Theodosius had reached adolescence on the 19th of July at about the eighth hour, the sun was so completely eclipsed that stars appeared. There appeared in the sky with the sun, while in eclipse, a cone-shaped light, which some out of ignorance called a comet. But it showed none of the features of a comet, For the light did not form a tail, nor was it at all like a star. Rather, it resembled a great lamp flame appearing on its own, with no star under it to form a wick for it. Its movement was also different. It began where the sun rises at the equinox. From there passed over the last star in the bear's tail and went on slowly westward. Close with quote. Clearly, Philostogius did not believe the object was a comet. Many reports from Europe and China, however, prove that it was. So the event goes down as the first reports of a comet seen during the total phase of a solar eclipse. The first famous solar eclipse after the year 1000 was on August 2nd, 1133. Visible in Scotland, totality was nearly 4.5 minutes in length, and this eclipse provides just one of the many historical examples of people wrongly associating a celestial spectacle with an earthly event. In his Historia Novella, written between 1140 and 1143, English historian William of Malmesbury links this eclipse to the death of King Henry I. Quote, "The elements manifested their sorrow at this great man's last departure from England. For the sun on that day at the sixth hour shrouded his glorious face, as the poets say, in hideous darkness, agitating the hearts of men by an eclipse. And on the sixth day of the week, early in the morning, there was so great an earthquake that the ground appeared absolutely to sink down, a horrid noise being first heard beneath the surface." Close quote. The problem is that the eclipse and the death occurred in different years. The account implies, 19th century author Mabel Loomis Todd writes in her book Total Eclipses of the Sun, quote, "that Henry must have died in 1133, which he did not, or else there must have been an eclipse in 1135, which there was not." But this is not the only labyrinth into which chronology and old eclipses, imagination and computation led the unwary searcher. Close quote. Quite true. For now, we'll stay in Scotland. The next three total solar eclipses are memorable because of the nicknames the Scottish people gave them. The June 17th, 1443 eclipse's totality lasted up to 4 minutes 26 seconds. It is remembered as the Black Hour. On March 7, 1598, a total eclipse known as Black Saturday had a duration of totality of 1 minute 29 seconds in the southeastern part of the country. Finally, Merc Monday refers to the eclipse that occurred April 8, 1652. In Edinburgh, residents experienced 2 minutes 47 seconds of totality. More fleeting was the hybrid solar eclipse, one that is annular at one or both ends of the path and total in the middle, of January 24, 1544. Totality lasted a mere 16.3 seconds. Dutch mathematician Gemma Friscius observed this event as a 95% partial eclipse from Belgium. Later, he published what may have been the first illustration of a camera obscura, a darkened room with a hole. Later versions used a lens, at one end that projects an image from outside onto the wall. Friscius's illustration shows the eclipse projected into the room. The next total solar eclipse worthy of our list was observed at sea by a Spanish admiral, Don Antonio Olola. His ship wasn't on an eclipse expedition. Its course simply intersected the path of totality. Talk about being in the right place at the right time. On June 24, 1778, he and his crew were heading to Cape St. Vincent from the Azores when they observed a totality lasting 4 minutes 50 seconds. Of the sighting, he wrote, "The darkness was such that persons who were asleep and happened to wake thought that they had slept the whole evening and only waked when the night was pretty far advanced. The fowls, birds, and other animals on board took their usual positions for sleeping as if it had been night." Close the quote. By the way, this was the first total solar eclipse observed in a brand new country called the United States. The path made landfall in modern-day Louisiana, still then a French colony, where totality lasted 4 minutes 31 seconds. It crossed into the U.S., then exited at the Atlantic coast of Virginia after totality had stretched to a whopping 5 minutes, 22 seconds. Before 1801, eclipse observations were largely descriptive in nature and primarily made to check the mathematical calculations of astronomers. It was during the 19th century, however, that science, mainly through the tools of spectroscopy and photography, entered the picture. The century's first notable total solar eclipse occurred June 16, 1806, and crossed the U.S. from Arizona to Massachusetts. The path of totality, whose length started at 3 minutes, 13 seconds, and stretched to 4 minutes, 48 seconds, touched 21 states, or areas that eventually would become states. Observers on the center line from positions north of Wichita, Kansas, through the state of Massachusetts, experienced more than 4 minutes of totality. While Plutarch described the corona he saw in 71 CE, it was Spanish astronomer José Joaquín de Fier who gave the sun's outer atmosphere that name after viewing the 1806 eclipse. He chose the word corona because it's the Latin word for crown. He also was one of the first observers who gave a convincing argument that this extended feature was part of the sun. Prior astronomers had debated whether it belonged to the sun or the moon. The annual eclipse of May 15, 1836 has an important place in history because an astronomer who observed it coined a term for a phenomenon millions of viewers had seen before and have seen since. English astronomer Francis Baily experienced 4 minutes, 22 seconds of totality from Jedburgh, England. Like others before him, including Edmund Halley, who wrote of points on the moon's limb during a 1715 eclipse, Baily described dots of sunlight often seen just before and just after totality, as well as during some annular eclipses. He called these points of lights beads, and explained that they appear because sunlight is passing through valleys located at the moon's irregular edge. These openings briefly let us see minuscule areas of the sun's surface. As a result of Baily's observations and work, we now call the phenomenon Baily's beads. The next solar eclipse on our list, July 28, 1851, is important for two reasons. First, English amateur astronomer and author George F. Chambers wrote that it was the first that spawned dedicated eclipse expeditions. The path of totality stretched from what is today Western Canada to Ukraine. European astronomers, however, targeted Norway and Sweden. Bergen, Norway, and Gothenburg, Sweden, both major cities, experienced 3 minutes, 17 seconds of totality. The second reason this event is notable is because during the 2 minutes, 56 seconds, the moon obscured the sun at the Royal Observatory in Königsberg, Prussia. A photographer named Johann Julius Burkowski took the first successful image of totality. He connected a camera that held a daguerreotype plate to a 2.4-inch refractor and made an 84-second exposure. During the total solar eclipse of August 18, 1868, two astronomers, Pierre-Jules César Janssen of France and J. Norman Lockyer of England, each independently discovered a new line in the sun's spectrum. Lockyer thought it showed an undiscovered element, which he named helium. In Greek mythology, Helios was the sun god. Although scientists would later show that helium is the second most abundant in the cosmos, it wasn't found on Earth for another 27 years. Also notable was the total solar eclipse of July 29, 1878, during which two groups of astronomers, while observing, discovered that more data could be gathered from higher altitude locations. An American group chose to watch the eclipse from the summit of Pikes Peak, which rises to 14,115 feet. A British group set up some 6,000 feet lower. Later, when their views of the corona were compared, those from the higher elevation were markedly better than the ones at the lower side because the air was much clearer at the former. The final total solar eclipse dimension is probably history's most famous because of its ties to Albert Einstein's theory of general relativity, which he published in full in 1916. The eclipse occurred 3 years later on May 29, 1919, and the duration of totality, 6 minutes 51 seconds, ranked it as one of the longest in the 20th century. Relativity proposed that space is curved by the mass of objects. To prove it, English astrophysicist Arthur Eddington led an expedition to the island of Principe off the west coast of Africa to photograph the sun during totality. If the theory were true, the sun's gravitational influence should shift the apparent position of nearby stars. Another scientific expedition with the same goal went to Sobral, Brazil. So when both teams returned from their travels, three members, Eddington, Frank Watson Dyson, and Charles Davidson, authored the paper, A Determination of the Deflection of Light by the Sun's Gravitational Field, from observations made at the total eclipse of May 29, 1919. In their conclusion, they state, quote, thus, the results of the expositions to Sobral and Principe can leave little doubt that a deflection of light takes place in the neighborhood of the sun and that it is of the amount demanded by Einstein's generalized theory of relativity, as attributable to the sun's gravitational field, end quote. It was an amazing confirmation of Einstein's theory. And again, this article was written by Michael Bakich. He's the contributing editor of Astronomy Magazine. There's little sidebars that are included with this article, as well as a number of photographs of a total solar eclipse. For example, the total solar eclipse of 1919 famously provided proof that general relativity is correct, as we've been talking about. In addition to the solar corona and a large prominence, also visible are background stars in Taurus the Bull, whose apparent positions were used to prove Einstein's theory. And there's a picture of that. And next to that, there's another picture of the 2017 total solar eclipse, making history as more than 10 million people viewed it. The next solar eclipse over the U.S. is in April 2024, which, of course, we're all preparing for eagerly here in Western New York. How and where are you planning to view it? That's the question everyone is being asked these last few weeks, isn't it? There's another little sidebar here that says that you can make it your own history. On April 8, 2024, you'll have a chance to etch such an event into your own historical record as a total solar eclipse sweeps across the U.S. With durations of totality longer than 4 minutes from the Mexican border to Indianapolis, this will be as much a must-see event as the August 2017 total solar eclipse, whose path tracked from Oregon to South Carolina. More than 10 million people viewed that event. In 2024, some 31.6 million people will already live in the path, and millions more probably will travel to it. Make sure you're one of them. And we are definitely already here, and we are awaiting more than a million visitors from outside of Western New York who are expected to come and view it from the Western New York area because, as National Geographic stated, Niagara Falls in particular is going to be probably the best place in North America, which is quite a state, in North America to view totality. So we're very happy for these visitors coming here to Western New York to take advantage of this once-in-a-lifetime event. Also in this article are some other pictures from top. We have a couple of pictures. Let me describe them for you because they are quite interesting. There's a series of sketches showing red solar prominences visible during the August 18th 1868 eclipse. Remember, it was during that eclipse that Pierre Janssen discovered a mysterious emission line in the solar spectrum, one due to then-unknown helium. And then the sketch underneath that, the detailed sketch of the corona and other solar features during the August 18th, 1868 totality, that appeared in an 1872 book by Heinrich Schellen. There's also quite a number of other depictions of eclipses of the sun. There's one plate, which is an annual eclipse. The next to that is an annual eclipse of the May 15th, 1836, showing Bailey's beads. Now, we read about that, and do you remember what those are? Then next to that is a total eclipse of the July 28th, 1851 eclipse, the eclipse of 1858, the total eclipse of the July 18th, 1860 eclipse, and a total eclipse of the July 8th, 1842 eclipse. It's kind of interesting to have depictions of these four eclipses all together so you can kind of see the differences. And what I'm noticing is that they all have the dark circular shape in the middle, and then around that, it what looks like sun rays coming out of that dark circular shape. But on three of those eclipses, there's also some very large, what looks like, probably not solar flares, but they kind of look like solar flares to me. The one has them shooting out in one, two, three, four different places. The other eclipse has a broader band of these flares shooting out in two opposite directions from that dark center round shape. And then the other eclipse, which is kind of the most interesting that I think, it's the eclipse of 1858. It has quite a number of different shapes that are surrounding that center dark round shape. And then around that are what kind of looks like petals of activity coming out of it. And then there's also some longer activities coming out of it, and some other splotches of different activity. That one seems to be kind of the most unique in its activity. The caption under these six different eclipses of the sun states, "As the moon blots out the sun, the solar corona appears in the sky. It never looks the same twice, as we've just been talking about, as evidenced by these sketches, each of a different annular or solar eclipse, which appeared in Mabel Loomis Todd's 1898 book, Corona and Coronet. Other phenomena appear in the drawings as well, including Bailey's beads, so we're going to know that term, and solar prominences." Again, you've been listening to All Eyes on the Eclipse, Probing the History and Mystery of Totality in Discover Magazine. And that's part of our special programming about the 2024 total solar eclipse. Stay tuned for more.
Hello, this is Marion Heatherly, Community Engagement Coordinator for the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. For the next hour and a half, we'll be exploring the 2024 total solar eclipse from the perspective of our listeners, Western New Yorkers and Southern Ontario Canadians who are blind or have another condition that makes reading print difficult. The interviews of local and national experts you'll hear were conducted the last week of March in preparation for this program airing on the day of the eclipse, but we may not always talk about the event in the present tense. A total solar eclipse is a once-in-a-lifetime visual event, and the Niagara Frontier is one of the best places in North America to watch the event because we sit directly in the path of the eclipse. The skies will darken for more than an hour, beginning just after 2 p.m. About 3:18 p.m., there will be 3 to 4 minutes of near-complete darkness as the moon moves between the sun and earth. Then the skies will lighten again over the course of another hour as the eclipse moves out of our region. But there's much more to experience through our other senses and feelings, and radio reading is there for you, as we always are, 24/7, with readings of newspapers, magazines, best-selling books, and other publications. Here's what we've been up to. First, we checked in with Dr. Andrew Reynolds. Dr. Reynolds is an ophthalmologist and clinical associate professor with the University of Buffalo's Jacobs School of Medicine and Biomedical Sciences. Dr. Reynolds, I understand you're cautioning everyone to take protective measures when experiencing the eclipse.
Correct. There's several things that I think people need to be aware about. And the most obvious one is that the sun is damaging to our eyes, right? And so this is really no different than an average day. It's just on average days, no one's tempted to do this. So since the dawn of time, everyone knows, yeah, you shouldn't look at the sun. We've been told that. And if you've ever tried, it hurts, right? And so we want to blink and turn away. So the eclipse is one of these like super rare events where you're actually kind of tempted to look at the sun. You want to see it because it's interesting. But the trouble is that a ton of the sun's light, depending on when you're looking, is still coming through. And the sun is so much brighter than any other light that we ever encounter. The brightest lights on Earth are way dimmer than what the sun is. And so even 1% of the sun is enough sun's rays and light energy that's still brighter than any light that we have, and that can actually cause permanent damage if you look at it. So the way to view the eclipse then is you have to have a filter. You have to decrease the amount of light that is coming to the back of your eye and meeting with your retina. And so those are the, what we call it, eclipse glasses, which are those ISO 123-122 international standard, and they filter over 99%. They filter over 99.9% of the light that comes and hits our eyes. So that then is a safe viewing experience. And anytime that you are actually seeing the sun, you have to have those on. In Buffalo, we're fortunate to get about 3 minutes of totality, meaning that the sun is completely occluded by the moon. That then it is safe to take your glasses off because you're actually not looking at the sun for that part. You're looking at those, the corona, which are those like solar flares that ring the moon in the eclipse. And the brightness of those is much dimmer. So they're about the brightness of a full moon. So that actually is safe to look at. It's just a very narrow window. And as soon as you get 1% of the sun coming back out, they call that the diamond ring sign, where you get this kind of big bead of light on the one side. As soon as you see that, boom, glasses got to come back on for the rest of the time. I think it is important to timestamp that for people. I don't know that if I said it, but 3:19 to 3:21. So that's the time you can like take your glasses off. So I think like one of the issues that we battled with is like you say totality, like does the average person understand that? So I do want to be kind of very specific about that. Like you don't have to look at the sun and know, you can look at your watch and set an alarm of 3:19 to 3:21.
What kind of damage are we talking about that could occur without protective measures?
So the disease entity we talk about is called solar retinopathy, or retinal damage from the sun. Solar retinopathy is unfortunately a disease that we do not have a good treatment for. It is direct photochemical damage to the light sensitive part, to the retina. And what happens is those retinal cells are just overwhelmed with the amount of light that there is. And it causes a tiny little burn hole. And the biggest trouble with solar retinopathy is because you're looking at the sun, you're using your very central part of your vision. Where you put that burn hole is right in the middle of your vision. So in the worst case scenario, you're left with a permanent big black dark spot in the center of your vision. That's where we need to read and see color and identify people's faces. You're left with a big burn hole in that area, and there is no treatment for that. And so that can result in worst case, that can result in permanent long-term blindness.
So do people who are already blind also need to take precautions?
So absolutely. So everybody does regardless. And the reason for that is the dose curve is kind of unknowable for each individual person. We don't know. So some people say, oh, can I look for 10 seconds? Can I look for 20 seconds? Well, the answer is like, we don't really know. And depending on what type of blindness the person has, it's actually going to affect that pretty drastically. So for instance, if someone has a corneal scar, they took a sharp stick in the eye, knife in the eye, something like that, and they have a big scar in the front part, they're going to actually transmit a lot less light. So in that sense, that person who is blind is probably a lot safer than you or I would be. However, if they're blind from glaucoma or macular degeneration, those people already have pre-existing retinal disease. So they've already lost 10, 20, 50, 90% of their retina. So now you're talking about, well, if they lose 10% of their retina, the whole rest of their vision is gone potentially. So those people, retinal disease people, are going to actually be at higher risk during the eclipse. So it really kind of depends on the individual person. But because that individual person and disease is hard to know, the blanket recommendation is everybody uses the same amount of eye protection.
And a variety of other health effects have been reported from an eclipse. Can you talk a little bit about that and whether people with certain medical conditions should take additional precautions? Because we know people who have blindness or other visual impairments often have other medical conditions as well.
Yeah, so people who are either innately more sensitive to the sun, so xeroderma pigmentosa would be one of those diseases that would have eye scarring, but also skin that's very sensitive. But another big class would be people who are on sun sensitive medicines. So some acne medicines are famous for that. So teenagers who are treating their acne are sometimes on medicines that actually sensitize you to the sun. So on a normal day-to-day risk, it's, hey, make sure you wear a lot of sunblock. So those people know, oh, I got to protect myself from the sun when I go to the beach extra compared to other people. Again, those people are not really told not to look at the sun because, again, day to day, we know not to do that. But on the eclipse day, someone who takes those types, those classes of medicines are actually going to be a little bit higher risk for the sun damage with the eyes.
Now, I understand also, though, that the eclipse, it's been reported that people have mood swings. It affects your blood flow, cardio, irregularities.
Absolutely. The animal kingdom responds too, right? So the birds start chirping and they talk about these deep sea fish kind of come up and migrate up to the surface that feed at night. And so, yeah, absolutely. And temperature is going to drop 10 to 15 degrees. So you absolutely will get, some certainly systemic type of changes. I mean, again, a 10 to 15 degree drop in temperature in 5 minutes is going to seem pretty intense and have, effects on your systemic circulation.
We should really be aware of all the kinds of physiological and atmospheric changes that are going on, yes?
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing I've warned people about is you got to try the glasses on first. They are extraordinarily dark, extraordinarily dark. They're blocking 99.9%. So I had never tried a pair on until this eclipse, and I was stunned about how dark. I mean, I was in a perfectly bright lit room, put them on, you could see nothing. And so this is also, you're going to have to be aware of your surroundings. So yes, these glasses are going to help you from the eye stuff, but I'm worried that people are going to stumble and fall. And if they're in a kind of a precarious, oh, I'm going to Niagara Falls, I'm going to kind of be leaning over or whatever, your peripheral vision is going to be nil in these glasses. So it is, you're going to want to kind of scope your spot. I'd probably say like sit down. And if you're watching with children that you want to watch out for too, it's going to be very hard to keep an eye on them, pardon the pun, keep an eye on them while you're looking at the eclipse with these really dark glasses on. So being aware of your surroundings, being in a safe place, making sure your kids and family members are all wearing the glasses properly is going to take more planning than I think a lot of people are planning.
And our listeners are people who are blind or have other visual impairments. Any additional advice for them in particular?
Well, so number one is that, and your listeners would know, but there's a common misconception when you say blind that the average person thinks, oh, they see nothing, right? That it's complete pitch black. And of course, that's not true. The vast majority of people who are blind are not like that at all. They can, many blind people can read. So legal blindness and blindness that is in the common parlance are very different. So absolutely, people who are blind are going to enjoy the eclipse because they can see. Most people who are blind still see. And even those with the worst vision who are light only they're going to know it got dark. They still can stand outside, feel the sun's rays, and all of a sudden it's going to feel like night to them. So what you were talking about, this kind of like multi-sensory experience of the eclipse, is absolutely going to be fun and interesting for even the visually impaired in Western New York. So absolutely, that's one of my tips, is just because you think you have vision impairment doesn't mean you can't go enjoy this. You should enjoy this just like people with normal vision. As we talked about, if they're on sun sensitive medicines or something, that does matter. The other thing is if they use special aids. And so there are people who are going to use magnifiers, telescopes, those types of appliances, and visual aids to help them. If you're going to look through those also have to be equipped with the right filters. And so if you have a telescope that you're planning on using, you got to get a sun filter that is also acceptable for viewing eclipses. So same as the glass, has got to be the right filter. You got to get the right filter for telescopes, binoculars, those kind of things. So if someone plans to use their visual aids that they normally use, just make sure that they're filtered.
What are your plans for April 8th?
So I do have a lot of interviews on that day. So I think I'm going to be shuttling around maybe more than anybody else in Western New York. And so I certainly have a bunch of interviews kind of lined up in the morning that day. But for the real spectacle, for totality, I'm going to watch with my family. So we're going to get together, watch that. And then later that night, we're actually doing a special emergency eclipse clinic. So for people who think that they've sustained eye damage, we're going to open up. So our offices are open in the morning. So we're going about 8 to 12, as we normally do. We're going to close from 12 to 4 to let everyone go enjoy the eclipse. And then starting at 4 till about 10, we're going to start back up again and have a night clinic in case people think that they've sustained any damage from the sun.
Tell us a little bit more about that. Where are those locations?
Yeah, so the location is going to be our flagship office, which is 1176 Main Street. It's the Ross Eye Institute, and we are going to have a fully functioning staff. We're going to have residents attending, surgeons, photographers. We're going to be really kind of all hands on deck for that day. Hopefully, we don't see anybody. So my dream is that we go there and when there's 10 eye doctors and we're all just twiddling our thumbs, that would be ideal for us, that we get the message out correctly. But if not, I think better safe than sorry. And so like, I would encourage people to, if they think they're having trouble, they should call us and come in. So it's going to function just like a normal clinic would, other than it's going to be at night and it's going to be just for eclipse related issues. Partially just because the volume of people that's expected is through the roof, right? I mean, I've heard a million people might come. So there's going to be a lot of eyeballs on this eclipse. And so we just, again, hopefully everyone does it safely. But for those who think that maybe they didn't, we're going to be around to try and help.
Dr. Andrew Reynolds is an ophthalmologist and clinical associate professor with the University of Buffalo's Jacobs School of Medicine and Biomedical Sciences. To help our listeners experience the total solar eclipse to its fullest, Radio Reading secured 10 oversized Braille blind assist eclipse maps developed by NASA and made them available to local viewing parties. We're privileged to talk with their creators, a team who's been making these types of maps available for the last 3 decades. Dr. Cassandra Runyon is a geology professor at the College of Charleston and director of the NASA South Carolina Space Grant Consortium. Her co-author is Dr. David Hurd, a geosciences professor and planetarium director at Penn West University at Edinburgh.
Thank you both for talking with us. Dr. Runyon, can you kind of take me back in time a little bit to what was happening in the disability community 30 years ago? I don't suppose that these types of resources were as available as they are today.
Good question. 30 years ago, gosh, what were we doing? Actually, David and I were starting these books. We had, our first book was about the solar system. And honestly, our technology to create these books has not changed a whole lot since then, because it's a tried and true, it works. We raised awareness within NASA itself. They got very excited with this first books, and then following on with a book on Mars and the moon and some of the geologic processes that form on the planets, that really helped create more interest and more support, so leading to us being able to create a few more of these books, such as The Eclipse.
You know what? I'd like to add to that, to what Cass said, that she's absolutely right. What we use to produce these hasn't changed, because right now it's the best method out there, thermoforming. But the technology has changed on how you access our books. So we put a QR code on the lower left-hand corner of every book that makes it easy for users to access.
And Dr. Hurd, so can you describe what's included in the map, please?
Sure. Yeah, so as Dr. Runyon said, our first Eclipse book was in 2017. So what we did was we kind of piggybacked on that same book that was produced in conjunction with NASA, and we added the paths of totality for 2017 and 2024, and we did the annular eclipse in 2023. So that's called the path of annularity. So when you open the book, there are three basic tactiles included. The first tactile kind of illustrates and highlights the conditions in order for a solar eclipse or an annular eclipse to occur, and that is at new moon. It can only occur at new moon, and that is when the moon is found between the sun and the earth. And so as you look at our book, tactile one really highlights that positioning of the sun, earth, and moon in between the sun and the earth. Okay, and as you might expect, the moon creates shadows, the earth creates shadows, and if the moon's shadow hits the earth, that's called a solar eclipse. So tactile one really highlights just the dynamics of that positioning of the sun, earth, and moon in order for a total solar eclipse to occur.
So we're talking about a map that comes in book form. And how did you determine the feel of each planet, and how did you determine the path of the eclipse, how that should be represented through touch?
That's a good question. Dr. Runyon and I have used lots of beta testers, if you will. We have a connection with the community of individuals that are blind or vision impaired that we use to kind of field test these different textures to try to get them to feel like they actually look. Now, that's a tough task, right? And so to do that, we use a lot of different materials, sand, doll hair.
Spanish moss,
sandpaper. And we've just kind of come up with some ideas of using things that have been field tested and agreed upon that work best for making these objects, whether it's the sun, whether it's the moon, whether it's the earth. So using different materials to make them feel kind of like they look.
One of the things that's important about our books too is we try to maintain consistency of the textures and the materials that we use. So clouds are always doll's hair, or in some cases, what the texture of the sun in this case is Spanish moss, and the sand denotes the continents of the earth.
I think that's important what Dr. Runyon says. A tactile is only as good as two things. Number one, consistency. Number two, the written description. So as I describe, as I would, or as Dr. Runyon would describe these tactiles, they're only as good as the written description that supports them, which, of course, comes back to our QR code that is found at the lower left-hand corner of each of our books. That's where the text is. That's where the descriptive text is. And so we distribute a lot of our books to teachers because, by the way, Marion, these aren't just for students or people that are blind or visually impaired. These are for all learners, because we're all kind of tactile to some degree. But I always emphasize, hey, scan that QR code, because all the beautiful information, important information is found in that QR code that will bring those tactiles alive. So tactile one, just showing the orientation of the earth, moon, and sun today in Rochester or Buffalo in northern New York. Tactile two shows from partial solar eclipse through totality, what we call totality, and then out through the rest of the eclipse. And tactile three in our eclipse book highlights a fractal of the continent of the United, or the United States of America, actually. Okay. And it shows the three paths that I mentioned earlier, the 2017 path of totality, and it goes through the states, the path of annularity from October of 2023 as it goes through the states, and the path of totality of the 2024 April 8th event as it goes, and it shows that it goes from Texas up through Arkansas. I'll probably miss some through Indiana, Illinois, Northern Ohio, Northwest Pennsylvania, and Northern New York, Vermont, New Hampshire, out through Maine. And those that aren't in that path that's marked on Tactile 3, they still get to enjoy something, but they only get to enjoy a partial solar eclipse. So, for example, if you live in Iowa, great, but you're not in the path of totality, but you can witness a partial solar eclipse.
And as you say, these books have to have a consistency because they may be about the eclipse, or you've developed these books on other topics as well, correct? So clouds in one book have to feel like, so you know that you're touching clouds in another book, for example.
Correct. Our book on the Earth, we talk about some climate change and how some satellites can record images and use it to support science. And so the clouds are consistent with that book, or the continent of the United States, or the continents on the Earth are consistent with the textures of the continents in our eclipse book, although miniaturized, but we use the same materials.
I must say, if I could add, Dr. Runyon is our kind of our artistic. She's got a great flair for art and make these masters that are quite spectacular. Not only are they tactily informative, but they're actually also beautiful. In our Earth book, she has one of the nicest hurricane I've ever seen. But that,
after that hurricane attacked me.
Yeah, there we go.
That's what I wanted to ask you guys, though, too, is that what other topics are these books available on?
Let's see. We started with the solar system and in general, and we worked through impact craters on the moon and the history of impact craters. And then the Earth, we talked about climate change and issues with melting, sea level rise, et cetera. Then we've got another update for the Apollo program, the 50th anniversary of the Apollo program for the moon. There's a book on Curiosity rover for Mars. And now David, we've just recently released the light pollution book. A comparison of what the night skies look like in urban versus rural areas. So for your audience in Buffalo, it's amazing. You've got so much light pollution there versus where David lives in rural Pennsylvania.
Yeah, so that light pollution book would take you from Buffalo, maybe into small town New York, and then out in the country in New York, what a constellation such as Orion would look like, or in this case, feel like, in different light polluted areas. We also have a book on small worlds in our solar system. So, you know, asteroids, comets, what we call minor planets or dwarf planets. We'll try to get them in your hands, Marion.
Well, that was going to be my next question, because this is so interesting that not only for folks who are blind or have other vision impairments, but like you say, everyone should be aware of the fullness of these topics. So how can others find out, what resources are available and how to get them?
We've been posting the content that the QR codes pair up with on the NASA Solar System Exploration Research Virtual Institute, or SERVES, website. And that is https://survey.nasa.gov/books. And from there, you will be taken to a page where you can select the particular content or the book that you are interested in. It will open up the text, which then you can enlarge or reduce the font if you choose to print it, or you can use your smart device to have the content read to you. And I just want to add, you asked earlier about the technology changes over 30 years. Well, David and I finally had an epiphany about, eight, nine years ago, that we can use the QR code to link to more than just text. We can actually have oral interviews such as we're doing here. So for the Earth book, for example, some of the content talks about penguin colonies on Antarctica. Well, we included interviews with those scientists and actually recorded sounds from the penguin colony that is included for the book. It enhances the content and the tactile touch or the parts that you can see.
And Dr. Runyon, what are you doing for the eclipse?
I am lucky to be going to rural Arkansas. Hopefully it won't be as busy as some of the larger cities, but I'm taking these books and I will be joining a group of college students that will be launching high altitude balloons with different instruments to record the changes in light and sound and temperature as the balloons fly up into totality. And I'll also be joined with some folks from NASA headquarters, one of whom is blind herself. So she's going to be talking about her experience with the eclipse.
Dr. Hurd, what are your plans?
Well, at Penn West University at Edinburgh, we have plants around our lake on campus. It's called Mallory Lake. So we've got food trucks. We have porta potties. What more does anybody need here? So today we're just enjoying the festivities here, and so we're really excited. And Dr. Runyon is going to be calling in to give a little report to our local radio station with us. And I have two other people from NASA calling in, one of which I haven't confirmed this yet, but Joe Manofra. And I think that bears mentioning because Joe works for NASA Survey, as Cass mentioned earlier, the Solar System Exploration Research Virtual Institute. And he is a key player in these books also. He helps us provide funding and directives of dissemination and stuff. So we really appreciate the efforts of NASA and Joe Manofra and Dr. Runyon. And so that's what we're doing.
And Dr. Hurd, since you're in Pennsylvania, the timing between us and you are going to be about the same. And then Dr. Runyon, you're in Arkansas. We're going to experience it just a little bit before we do.
Correct. Just a few seconds to a minute or two before y'all.
We thank you for providing the books to us because we got them from you. So thank you very much. We've been speaking with the creators of NASA's Blind Assist Eclipse Map, Dr. Cassandra Runyon, a geology professor at the College of Charleston and director of the NASA South Carolina Space Grant Consortium, and Dr. David Hurd, a geosciences professor and planetarium director at Penn West University at Edinburgh. Dr. Runyon, would you like to give that website one more time for us?
Sure. https://survey.nasa.gov/books.
Thank you very much.
Sound also plays a role in the eclipse. Radio reading is helping scientists study this as part of NASA's Eclipse Soundscapes Citizen Science Project. Let's meet the project co-lead.
Hi, I'm Mary Kay Severino, the Education Director at Arisa Lab. I co-lead the Eclipse Soundscapes Project alongside Dr. Henry Trey Winter, the Chief Scientist at Arisa Lab. The Eclipse Soundscapes Project is studying how life on Earth, specifically wildlife, is affected by solar eclipses, and by participating, you are helping us answer this science question. During a solar eclipse, the moon slowly creeps in front of the sun, blocking the sun's light from reaching the Earth. And during the minutes before, during, and after eclipse maximum, when most or all of the sun is blocked from view, it's going to seem like dusk or night has come early. Nature looks and sounds and feels differently during dusk, night, dawn, and day. Different animals and insects appear and start making noises at dusk as it starts to get dark. Others are out at night, like crickets or owls. As the sun starts to rise at dawn, a dawn chorus begins. and then the daytime animals and insects appear. Solar eclipses can seem like a very sped up version of the day-night cycle. And when there is a solar eclipse, this is happening in the middle of what should be daytime. How nature, and specifically animals, respond to solar eclipses is something scientists have been wondering for a while. Almost 100 years ago, a scientist named Wheeler asked people to mail letters to him and his colleagues with their eclipse observations. Their observations included visual and sound observations on how the 1932 total solar eclipse affected nature, showing that eclipses can be studied and experienced in a multi-sensory way. The Eclipse Soundscapes Project revisits Wheeler's 100-year-old study with modern means of communication and modern technology. We are asking you, all of the general public, to get involved just like Wheeler did. There are many ways that people can get involved in the Eclipse Soundscapes Project. You can be an apprentice who learns about the eclipse. You can be an Eclipse Soundscapes observer who goes outside on eclipse day, takes down multi-sensory observations, and submits those observations online. You can be an Eclipse Soundscapes data collector who uses an audio recording device called an AudioMoth to collect audio data during Eclipse Week. Or you can be an Eclipse Soundscapes data analyst who helps us analyze all of the audio data after the eclipse. Information about each of these roles can be found on eclipsesoundscapes.org.
Between April 6th and April 10th, Radio Reading is collecting local neighborhood sounds using that special AudioMoth recorder. How does that work, Mary Kay?
Eclipse Soundscapes data collectors will be using a device called an AudioMoth to collect audio data for 5 days during the week of the eclipse. The AudioMoth is a device that is about half the size of a cell phone. It is a simple-looking but powerful device. It has a circuit board with 3 AA batteries attached to it, and it can collect scientific-level audio. Eclipse Soundscapes data collectors will collect 5 days of audio data so that we can compare the audio that is collected on eclipse day with the audio at that same time of day on non-eclipse days. The non-eclipse day audio provides important baseline data information. Without it, we would not be able to determine if the audio recorded during the eclipse is how that specific location always sounds at that time of day. Because Wheeler invited the general public to submit their 1932 eclipse observations, Wheeler was able to collect so much more data than his team could have on their own. Wheeler collected approximately 500 observations. For that same reason, the Eclipse Soundscapes Project is inviting the general public to get involved in data collection alongside of us. We can collect so much more together, and it is important to do it now because there won't be another total solar eclipse that passes over the United States until 2044. If you don't have an AudioMoth recording device and would still like to be involved in the Eclipse Soundscapes Project, we hope you will participate as an Eclipse Soundscapes observer, which doesn't require any equipment. Eclipse Soundscapes observers will observe the sights and sounds during the eclipse using whatever senses are available to them, take notes, and then submit those observations via a web form on eclipsesoundscapes.org after the eclipse, but before April 15th. You can be located anywhere to be an Eclipse Soundscapes observer, on, near, or off the eclipse path. And again, no equipment is necessary. We can learn and figure out so much more together. We hope you will get involved.
That was Mary Kay Severino, co-lead of the Eclipse Soundscapes Project and education director at Arissa Lab. As she mentioned, anyone can share their observations about how the eclipse sounds and feels, and you can do it via social media with the hashtag EclipseSoundscapes at your location. You can also download the free Eclipse Soundscapes app available on its website for a countdown clock and rumble map that lets users hear and feel the eclipse on their smart device as it happens. Another free app NASA helped develop to enhance your experience is called Total Solar Eclipse. Key features include narrated live streams and educational programming, interactive audio maps that can be tailored to your location, and a concert automatically scored in real time by translating sound data from the eclipse into music notes. You're listening to special programming created by the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service on the 2024 Total Solar Eclipse. We're talking about the eclipse from a multi-sensory perspective. Joining a viewing party is another way to experience the collective feel of the event. One of those parties is being held by the Whitworth Ferguson Planetarium on the Buffalo State University Athletics Field. Jen Connolly is the planetarium's associate director. Jen, tell us about your viewing party.
At Buffalo State, we've been focused on the eclipse in so many ways for the last year. It's hard to believe it's almost here. We wanted to fully celebrate this once-in-a-lifetime event and highlight how it can, even as a celestial phenomenon, inspire immense curiosity and creativity for us here on Earth. And on E-Day itself, we'll be hosting several hundred, up to 2,500 people actually on campus for what we are calling Eclipse Fest. We wanted to offer an accessible location that people could gather for it. And throughout the event, guests will be guided by myself and another expert, our planetarium's director, Dr. Kevin Williams. We'll also have live entertainment, eclipse swag, food trucks, the works. And community building is so important, especially right now, I think. This was in the forefront of my mind when we began developing our E-Day event. So we'll have activities and demos for all ages, including two light sound devices at our site.
A total solar eclipse is quite a rare opportunity, so another reason to enjoy it to its fullest, yes?
Yeah, a total solar eclipse is really a rare opportunity for us. The next total solar eclipse won't occur in Buffalo until October of 2144. And if you were to stand anywhere on Earth and just wait for a total eclipse, you'd wait an average of about 370 years. So it's definitely a once-in-a-lifetime event for most locations, and I think a rare opportunity for an amazing, huge communal experience. When I think of all the people who've been working in Buffalo together to make this a safe, awe-inspiring event, I'm really blown away. And as a science communicator, I find this epic event has also allowed us to decentralize STEM learning more into our communities, creating access and spreading excitement. Even today, when we understand what's really causing and happening during total eclipses, they move people to feel a kind of reverence for the beauty of our universe. And research actually studied this feeling of awe during the 2017 total eclipse in the US. They used data from millions of users on Twitter, now called X. A professor of psychology at the University of California, Irvine, found those that were in the path of totality tended to use the pronoun we as opposed to I, and also express concern about other people. So we're finding that experiences that bring humans awe seem to attune people and connect us to one another. And for some, that also means connecting to entities that are larger than themselves. This year, they're planning to study to see if the eclipse experience has any effect on political divisions in society, and I can't wait to see what they find there.
Can you talk a bit about what other than visual changes can occur during an eclipse?
A total solar eclipse is a multi-sensory event. There are obvious sights during totality, when the sky will become dark as if it were dawn or dusk, and stars, planets, and the sun's corona will be visible. But as totality nears, you may also pick up a perceptible drop in temperature. The wind may pick up or die down, or it may change direction. And as the sunlight dims, you may notice animals, birds, and insects acting in a peculiar manner. And during totality, I would say listening to the people around us is also part of that experience too. Many people have a deep emotional response when the sun goes into totality. Eclipse veterans like to use the phrase experience totality rather than see totality, because a total solar eclipse is the only celestial phenomenon, I think, that truly overwhelms the senses. So scientists, professional and citizen, will be tracking what happens during the eclipse in multiple wavelengths across the electromagnetic spectrum. During a total solar eclipse, the normal rhythms of Earth are briefly disrupted, providing a really unusual opportunity for scientists to study the atmosphere of our solar-powered planet. The total eclipse will afford scientists a chance to study changes in part of the Earth's upper atmosphere that's known as the ionosphere. And that's an important part because it affects radio waves used for communication and navigation. And so disturbances in that layer can cause issues with GPS and communications. During this total solar eclipse, not only will NASA be launching multiple sounding rockets, but hundreds of radio amateurs will take to the airwaves to study the sun itself. So while there'll be lots of imagery in the optical, there will be a lot of other data gathered outside of that narrow visible window during the eclipse. About 40 citizen science projects are planned for it that I know of, and they range from using a phone app to register the temperature and cloud cover to recording ambient noise during the event. And I'm happy to say too that since NASA has a commitment to open science, that means that all this data that's captured during the eclipse from all over the U.S. will be readily accessible for all too.
Buffalo is one of the cloudiest cities in the country. How much will changes in the weather impact everyone's experience?
Yeah, I have actually been asked if the eclipse could be rescheduled to a more convenient, less cloudy time of year. But, you know, April is a month of transition across our whole continent. Our winter storms are gradually giving way to the convective buildups of spring and summer. And so, I mean, Buffalo is certainly a cloudy city, but the timing of this eclipse makes it a real coin toss as to whether we'll have clear skies. So, worst case scenario, spectators might only experience the darkening of the clouds during the eclipse. Animals and plants will notice that difference in the lack of sun too. Total solar eclipses offer a unique opportunity to witness a temperature drop due to the lack of the solar radiation. So on a clear day with low humidity and light winds, a total solar eclipse lasting close to 4 minutes, like the one we'll have here, could actually give a temperature drop of about 8 degrees. However, with the presence of clouds and thus the higher humidity, temperatures may only drop a degree. So the cloud cover acts as a blanket to keep heat from escaping into space. We'll just have to cross our fingers for clear skies that day.
You mentioned many people have a deep emotional response to eclipses. Can you explain that more, please?
During these celestial spectacles, nothing's special, really, in terms of how the sun is behaving. And in terms of humans, there are no known physical effects. However, eclipses have had a special power over humans for millennia. The oldest recorded eclipse in human history may have been around 3340 BCE, I believe, in Ireland. So, and basically imagine Irish Neolithic astronomer priests at this site recording events on stones. And there were three events relating to an eclipse as seen from that location. And we know eclipses were recorded in ancient Egypt as early as 4,500 years ago, and ancient eclipse records made in China and Babylonia are believed to be over 4,000 years old. One Chinese legend reports that official imperial astronomers were executed because they failed to predict the total solar eclipse in China in 2134 BCE. So they've been a very big deal for humans for a very long time. Chinese, Indian, Incan, West African, and many Native American cultures, to name a few, have amazing stories and traditions around eclipses. Often, eclipses were seen as portents, not usually good ones. There were many spiritual explanations for solar and also lunar eclipses that helps earlier humans make sense of these sort of seemingly inexplicable and random phenomena.
We know, too, that eclipses have inspired many scientific discoveries about our world.
Eclipses have definitely inspired humans both artistically and scientifically for centuries now. In the late 1800s, by observing the corona surrounding the sun and measuring the makeup of the light, scientists were able to discover the element helium. The name helium even comes from the Greek word for sun, which is helios. In 1919, scientists used a total eclipse to observe a bent path of starlight. This bending of starlight was produced by a bending of space-time. At least that's what had been predicted by Einstein in his theory of general relativity. But this was the first time conclusive observational evidence was found to support that. And that general relativity replaced our understanding of basic physics. In 1932, during an eclipse, several scientists observed animal behavior, finding that animals can be temporarily tricked into thinking it's nighttime, with crickets chirping, birds falling silent, bees returning to hives. So that's another example. And more recently, scientists have found that all types of solar eclipses can change the wind direction, attributed mostly to the change in temperatures that happened during totality. Total eclipses have also helped scientists decipher the very structure of the sun and better understand its explosive events too. Observing the sun's outer atmosphere during eclipses helps us refine the models that we as scientists use to predict how solar material will travel outward from the sun, ultimately manifesting as disturbances in near-Earth space, and that's what we call space weather. So these are just a few highlights of what has been found and what's currently being studied during solar eclipses.
Anything else you'd like our listeners to know so they can experience the eclipse to its fullest?
Yeah, I think I'd just like to reiterate that not only is the eclipse a multisensory experience because of temperature and wind and behavior of the animals around us, but also, it's such an amazing opportunity to connect with each other and to inspire the next generation of scientists. I sincerely hope that we have many scientists in the making, younger people especially, who are going to be able to access this eclipse in ways that previously had not been available, and that we're reaching more and more people this time around. I have my fingers crossed for a beautiful afternoon from at least 2 o'clock in the afternoon to 4:30 p.m. in the afternoon for all of us. And I hope everyone makes the most of this really astonishing event. I can't wait to share it with Buffalo.
Thank you, Jen. Jen Connolly is Associate Director of the Whitworth Ferguson Planetarium at Buffalo State University. They're holding an E-Day viewing party on the university's athletic field.
Another inclusive viewing party is being held at Genesee Valley Park in Rochester. It's hosted by the Southeast Area Coalition, which promotes quality of life by connecting people and organizations with resources. Joining us are Kiki Smith, the Coalition's Fundraising and Outreach Coordinator, Anita O'Brien, Executive Director of Rochester Accessible Adventures, and Janine Stanley, Director of Customer Success and Engagement at IRA. Kiki, I understand you wanted to experience the partial solar eclipse in 2017, but found it difficult and disappointing. Can you tell us about that experience?
Sure. Thank you, Marian, for having us this morning. I really appreciate the opportunity. And I've been spending a lot of time thinking back to that experience in 2017, which seems so very long ago. I had teenage boys at the time, and there was quite a bit of buzz here in Rochester, despite the fact that we were not particularly close to the path of totality, about it was summertime and, you know, middle of the day, having the darkness. Everybody was very, very excited about it. And I initially was very dismissive that, you know, this was just for a couple minutes on a random day. And what was the big deal? That society was kind of steroidizing it for commercial purposes. And yet, suddenly, there I was all by myself while everybody else was gathered in parks and at parties. And I was drawn outside to my porch where, you know, I really found myself trying to tune into ways that I might be able to perceive that dramatic change. I have no light detection left at this point, so I knew that was not going to happen, but I'd heard enough about ways that nature would also come to stillness, that the birds would stop singing and that it would just be very heavy and quiet. And I was really wanting to experience that. Not finding myself doing that, I tuned into a couple of radio broadcasts to try to hear it. And I just found myself very frustrated and very sad, surprisingly, after having been blown the whole thing off, that I couldn't really get it. Like everybody else was oohing and aahing and screeching and hollering. So it was tough. I wrote about it, which is one of the ways that I process, you know, emotional experiences, and shared that with uncharacteristically on social media. And it came back to haunt me last summer when somebody remembered it. Beth Adams from WXXI here in Rochester, our public broadcasting station. And she kind of tickled my memory and inspired what has transpired since then in terms of our celebrating this event a little differently in community.
Kiki, at what age did you lose your sight, if you don't mind telling us?
No, not at all. I was diagnosed as legally blind in 1980. At 8 years old, I was having trouble seeing the chalkboard and became legally blind pretty quickly in a matter of months due to a degenerative autoimmune condition called uveitis. And was able to maintain through a lot of medical and surgical treatments and therapies a great deal of vision. I was what they called a high partial. I didn't even use a white cane for many years. Not that I shouldn't have, but I'm a stubborn Italian. Until 2010, in 2003, I really started losing a great deal of vision quickly. And by late in 2010, early 2011, I had lost the last of that light detection.
Janine, have you heard other stories like Kiki's about feeling left out of big events, not just eclipses, but other kinds of things?
Oh, definitely. Definitely. And this is why also IRA has decided to start an event service so that people can have, you know, there's an increase in audio description around for large television events, but there's nothing for these kinds of live big cultural events and big scientific events. And yes, I have heard stories like that. I am also totally blind, and I had a kind of a similar experience in 2017. I went outside and I tried to experience as much of it as I could, but then one of my neighbors was mowing his lawn. And it was so incongruous. It was like, wait, there's this giant, you know, celestial event going on and you're mowing your lawn? Okay. But I think that's why we wanted to get involved and be sure that we can bring this experience to everyone.
How did you incorporate inclusiveness and accessibility into the planning for your own viewing party today?
So IRA is, if people are not familiar, we are a provider of visual interpreting services. This is kind of a new thing. This is sort of that sighted person wherever you need them to interpret visual aspects of things. And we have been doing this now since 2015. So we're fast approaching our 10th year as a company. And we have trained professional visual interpreters and a secure service to provide that visual interpreting. But we're also lucky enough that some of those visual interpreters have other amazing skills. And my producer, Sid, is one of those people. And when Kiki came to us and said, hey, could you guys take part in this event? We said, well, of course we could. In part because we did a survey of our customers and they said, we want more coverage of cultural and live events. And so as we're planning this, we're looking at, okay, how are we going to work with Kiki and her team, with the entire event team, to really provide description of what's going on? And then how do we work that description into the program that they have? So it's, I think we're there. I really, you know, it's hard to believe 2 weeks, only 2 weeks. So I think we're there, and I think we're going to add hopefully a little something to what is already an amazingly accessible event.
So let's talk a little bit more about that. That's a one particular really cool aspect of your viewing party. So you all have organized this audio interpreted broadcast from the event. It's available on YouTube at youtube.com/C/AIRAIO. And we'll give that web address again in a minute. But talk a little bit about more about how that live stream is going to add to this event.
Sure. Well, what we're going to do is for people around the world, and we literally have customers around the world. And so what we're going to do is have our visual interpreters and Sid and myself on YouTube. We're going to be viewing the event through volunteers who will have their cell phone cameras trained around the park and looking at the sky. And as the program starts, we're going to be describing the program for folks so they can tune into our YouTube channel. But once we get to that point of totality, that's when they turn the mic over to us, when their program ends, and our interpreters go live throughout the park, if you can imagine. No pressure, right? So our interpreters are going to be, pardon me, our interpreters are going to be watching through these volunteer cell phone cameras and describing what they see. And that's not only going to be the sky, the corona, or the environment as things change, but also people's reactions and what they see around the park. Once the period of totality is over, we're going to switch back exclusively to our YouTube channel. The program will go on as per schedule, but we'll be describing that via YouTube. So we've got a little 2.5 minutes of fame, I believe, for the people in Rochester. But then for the people around the world, they'll get to see the Eclipse Party and all of the really cool things that are planned for Genesee Valley Park.
And Anita, your background is in therapeutic recreation, and your organization, Rochester Accessible Adventures, does a lot of that kind of thing. So you had a big part in planning the activities for this viewing party. Can you tell us about some of that, please?
Yes, it's been fantastic to work with Kiki and the Southeast Area Coalition. And really what they are doing is exemplary of a larger movement that we're working on creating within our area, setting in motion this sense that we can and will really train ourselves as communities to go beyond this particular event, but we've been using it as a training excursion for people to learn that we already know that people experience life in a variety of different ways: sensory experience, mobility, physical experience, cognition, processing. We already know that about ourselves. So taking that information and translating it into actions that we can do as event planners and service providers within the community ahead of time, so that when we are extending our invitation to the party, we know that everyone can come to that. And so it's been really neat to be a part of that. I think I've been a part of the stakeholder task force, I feel like maybe for 5 years leading up to this event. And then in these last 2 years, really being a part of going not only Greater Rochester, being a part of the conferences and workshops across the United States. I was able to go to Albuquerque to be a part of workshops down there with the American Astronomical Society to really infuse this into the planning stages, so that on the day of, we're not either leaving somebody at home from the party, or when they get there saying, okay, you're like that, so you go to the left and the rest of your family and friends can go to the right. But really looking at this as collective experience. And the Southeast Area Coalition event is the embodiment of that, where from the play part of it leading up to 323 and to the party and celebration afterwards, it's engaging, and it was really intentionally planned for a variety of people to experience that play as well as that momentous occasion. So it's been a fantastic journey working with Kiki and her team, and really seeing them run with it, you know, having been given some of the tools and the thoughts, and then just seeing it implemented has been fantastic.
So tell us about what kind of other activities. We heard about the really cool audio interpreted broadcast, and what other activities will be part of the viewing party?
Well, this is Kiki again. You know, I think I wanted to follow up on something Anita said,
sure,
that about this being really a community-wide event. We are co-hosting this party, this celebration, with one of our local public high school's robotics teams and the school itself. And in concert with them, we've collected variety of other community stakeholders and organizations who will be part of those experiences. Everything from massage and wellness to the Guiding Eyes for the Blind puppies in training to one of our local nonprofits, Writers and Books, some of the Creating Assets, Savings and Hope through Empire Justice. We'll have lots of community resources. And this really is sort of like an orchestral debut of how we as a society can put our minds and our hands and our hearts together to create something inclusive. It's not a personal redemption story from 2017. You know, it's about, as Anita shared, shifting that paradigm. I did find it kind of, you know, interesting that folks are this excited about 3.5 minutes of darkness. And so I figured, well, I could give them a few more hours if they want to get on the back of a tandem bike. Our Community Bikes is another one of the community partners who will be providing experiences on the backs of tandem bicycles that day, or audio darts, playing audio darts or audio cornhole. Anita and I actually met years ago when I was involved with the Rochester Area Blind Athletes and the blind baseball team the baseball that we have here in town, who will also be there that day. So those are some of the other exciting activities or interactive exhibits that folks can take part of. Another one of the inclusive-minded pieces is the use of the light sound device that Harvard has created to transform the changing of the light into sound, incrementally decreasing in tone in a musical way for folks who, with no light detection, to experience that subtle shift of the light from bright to dark, which is great because it's constant objective feedback about the eclipse light experience, and then augmented with the human language interpretation that Ira will be providing. It's going to be a really robust opportunity for folks. And, you know, we'll have ASL interpretation there. We have handicapped bathrooms. We've thought about as many of the kinds of mobility challenges as we can. But what we really, really hope as an organization that brings resources to the community is that this will shift the paradigm for other events in the future, other organizations and businesses as they continue to create events and programming to think from the ground up about, you know, will there be handicapped parking places? What will be the challenges to getting into the building for folks with mobility challenges? Oh, we have an ASL interpreter. Do we have an audio interpreter? Do your sort of shopping for some of those local resources.
So that brings up, you know, how much media coverage there actually has been of this eclipse. It's been extraordinary, international, right? So overall, it sounds like we still have a ways to go for inclusiveness and accessibility in our conversations, correct?
Yes, I would say so. Often it's an afterthought. It's hard to know another person's experience without having lived it. I'm an English teacher by trade. Take you back to Kill a Mockingbird, Harper Lee. You don't know until you walked a mile in another man's shoes. But we're living in a day and age where IDEA is really being embraced. And it's been wonderful, the local and regional and national media coverage that we've had. We just hope that it applies to more than this one event on April 8th, that it will get folks thinking more broadly about what each of us can do to plan and think from the start in removing the ask. That's Anita's hashtag. I'm giving her full credit for that one. But removing the ask, will you have ASL? Are there handicapped bathrooms? That it will already have been thought of in preparation for any event or building, construction, programming in the future.
Janine, you probably would like to expand upon that because that's what your organization is all about.
Absolutely. And as we start our event coverage, as we start really providing visual interpreting for things across the board, we want people to expect it like they expect ASL. We want them to, oh gosh, we have to be sure that we accommodate the deaf people. Oh, wait, there might be visually impaired people. And visual interpreting isn't just for visually impaired people. I like that Anita brought up all of the many challenges, neurodiversity, cognition, all of those things. Having that spoken input can really help folks who maybe get overloaded in these kinds of situations and just need one source of input for that. I think it's exciting that you all are thinking of everything when it comes to this event, including, you know, how people are getting there, how they're getting around the park, all that kind of thing. And I want to play accessible cornhole.
I told you I have an extra bedroom. You can come.
Anita, I'm going to give you the last word.
I just have to say, Beth Wagmeister on LinkedIn is the where I found remove the ask as the hashtag, and I love it because our hashtag is make inclusion happen. You know, just as straightforward. We have the tools, we have the resources. Let's make it happen. And one of those ways is definitely not expecting people to have to ask for any of these ways that make their experience more meaningful to them. And I do believe what's wonderful in our region is that some of these amenities and devices are going to be scattered across our geographic region in other events as well. And while bringing this focus to Southeast Area Coalitions to really magnify the potential of removing asks has been wonderful within the media. And then highlighting this and spreading it throughout the region, as Kiki has said, forevermore. And let's not just rest on this one amazing event, but saying that, you know, pretty much everyday life is amazing. So let's go forth and remove all the asks in everyday life as well.
We've been listening to Anita O'Brien, Janine Stanley, and Kiki Smith. They're organizers of today's Total Eclipse of the Park, an inclusive viewing party at Genesee Valley Park in Rochester. Here's that web address again. You can access the audio interpreted broadcast of the event on YouTube at youtube.com/C/AIRAIO. You're listening to special programming created by the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service on the 2024 total solar eclipse. The light sound device we mentioned was created by the Light Sound Project at the Center for Astrophysics, a partnership of Harvard University and the Smithsonian Institution. We talked with center astronomer Allison Barilla to learn more. Allison, can you tell us, what is the Light Sound Project?
Yeah, the Light Sound Project is essentially our project, our effort to get these light sound devices that we developed in 2017 out to the community. So the light sound device is a tool that we designed with the blind and low vision community in mind. It takes light and converts it to sound. It's a simple 3D printed case, and inside it has very simple Arduino components that have a very high dynamic range light sensor, and then a microcontroller board, which kind of is the heart of the device. And then, so it's basically reading the intensity of light. And as light changes, so as the moon eclipses the sun, the light will change. That's getting measured. And then through a MIDI component, we're able to map it to instruments. So the bright range of light is mapped to a flute. The mid-range is a clarinet. And then the low light goes to a kind of a low clicking sound.
Well, you do have a demonstration on your website. I'm going to play that for us now. Can you explain a little bit about what we just heard?
So, yeah, so in bright light, you kind of hear that nice bright flute sound is what we were thinking. And then basically there's a sensor that's being covered by a little circle cardboard. And so it's kind of a demonstration of what you might expect during an eclipse. You know, that's, of course, very sped up, this demo. But essentially, as the light starts to get dimmed, the pitch will change. And it goes from that flute sound to the clarinet, and then during totality, you know, where you have kind of this absence of light, we wanted to create the absence of sound. And so it kind of goes to this clicking sound, and the clicking even slows down during totality. So it kind of doesn't, we don't want to distract you from everything else that's going on when you're listening to the sound. The light's dimming, sound's dimming, you know, birds react, the temperature changes. It's a full experience.
So that 22-second sound clip that we just heard, that would actually be what time period?
Yeah, so it kind of depends. So the the dramatic change of light kind of happens in the last minutes of as you're going into totality. So it's really only over a few minutes, or, you know, 10 minutes or, you know, so when this dramatic change is happening. So this is kind of like the main part that would be changing the sound as well during that time, during full totality.
So there are some light sound devices here in the Western New York area being used at today's total solar eclipse. Let's listen to it again so people can get a better idea of what to be listening for. Pretty cool. So this can be used by anyone to listen to an eclipse during or after the event. How is this light to sound translation used by astronomers like yourself?
Yeah, so when we designed this device, we were specifically thinking about solar eclipses, but really, you're right, the device could be used for anything, any kind of changing light. So whether that's sunlight, whether that's, you know, indoor light. So, you know, I've heard people say, like, I just want to know if the light's on, so they can get used to the sound and kind of use that as a tool to know if the light's on or off. But, you know, I was thinking about it in the context of, you know, teaching and labs. I manage the labs and telescopes that we use for teaching undergraduates at Harvard. And so, you know, the idea was, you know, how do we make sure that all these labs are accessible to all of our students? And so using a device that records sound instead of visually with light, we can certainly do many of the same labs in the same way, in the same context. So so I'm not blind or low vision, but I did collaborate with a colleague who is blind. Her name is Wanda Diaz-Merced, and she was at the Center for Astrophysics at the time in 2017. And so we were having a lot of these discussions about making the labs accessible, and it happened to be the summer of the Great American Solar Eclipse, so we started thinking about the solar eclipse as well. And she uses sonification for her research. She's kind of a pioneer in the field, and that's how she interprets data. And so at the time, I was not as familiar with sonification, which is literally just taking data and converting it to sound. But I've learned a lot in the last 7 years, so I'm excited to be part of this project.
So it has many applications, and that's kind of the wonderment about eclipses too. The data that comes out of them can be used in so many different ways.
Yeah, and we're hoping that, so we've built and distributed 900 of these devices across the path, which is many more than the three that we had in 2017. So we're thrilled about that, and we've gotten, you know, just an enormous amount of requests, but we're just so happy that we have so many of these out there, because, you know, these devices are fantastic, that you can listen to the eclipse. You can put headphones on, you can attach it to a speaker and project it to an event. But it also has the capability of connecting to a computer, so you can collect data or plot the data. And so we're hoping that many of these devices will be used to collect data, and then we'll collect it as a group afterwards, and then have this wonderful repository of data where, you know, teachers, for instance, can go and grab data sets to, you know, teach about eclipses or, you know, talk about it in their class or demonstrate it.
And that's another reason why we're also encouraging people to experience this eclipse as a multi-sensory event, not just a visual event.
Yeah, I think, you know, even a sighted a person can enjoy an eclipse with sound. You know, I've heard of some astronomers that are sighted, that are, you know, interpreting their data visually, looking at a plot, but also listening to that data being sonified, because your ears can kind of pick up subtleties that your eyes can't. Or sometimes when you're listening to multisensory things, you kind of interpret things differently or hear things and see things in a way that you wouldn't normally. So I think it gives it another dimension, and it's kind of fun and exciting.
So what kind of reactions have you received from people using the device?
Just excitement. I think that we've gotten a lot of, like, thank you emails. And, you know, I just saw an article yesterday with this a student from the School from the Blind in Arkansas has a device, and she was just talking about how she's just so excited and thrilled that she's going to be able to experience the eclipse with her, you know, classmates. And I think that, that's really one of the important things about this device is providing resources and tools. You know, this is just one, but, you know, providing that for students that they can get excited and experience the eclipse and, you know, engage in the STEM field when, you know, a blind person can interpret data just like anyone else. They just need the tools and resources to do it. And, you know, this doesn't solve the problem, but this is one step toward that. And I'm excited to be a part of that.
Anything else that we should be talking about that you'd like folks to know about the project?
Yeah, I think the two things that come to mind is one, this project is completely open source. So if someone is interested in learning more about it, they can go to the website and they can get instructions to build their own device. Everything is on there that you'd need. The instructions are in English, Spanish, and French, the primary locations that the CLIPS goes through, primary languages for the locations. There's 3D printed case instructions, all the codes online, everything's there. The other thing is this is a very small team of us that are working on this, but we have really engaged with local communities to build these devices. I said we build 900 of them, and we only did that because we were running workshops to get people to help us build these. And in those workshops, we had people come in that often, most of the time, had no soldering experience, had no idea how to solder, and we taught them to solder, and then they learned this new skill, they helped us build these devices, and it gave us an opportunity to then donate those back to the community. So this has really been a community effort, and we're so thankful for all the help that we've gotten along the way.
And like you say, you guys have built so many more of these, even just since the 2017 eclipse. It sounds like it's growing all the time.
Yeah, it's enormous. We've gotten over 2,500 requests, and I wish we had, you know, unlimited devices to give out. But hopefully after the eclipse, we can redistribute some of the devices to people that are interested in using them after the eclipse, and we'll continue to keep building them, and eclipses happen every day.
We've been talking with astronomer Allison Barilla, who works with the Light Sound Project through the Center for Astrophysics, a partnership of Harvard University and the Smithsonian Institution. You're listening to special programming created by the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service on the 2024 total solar eclipse. We also talked with Dr. Holly Schreiber, chief scientist at the Buffalo Science Museum and TIFF Nature Preserve. She viewed the partial solar eclipse in 2017. So Dr. Holly, can you tell us what it was like in 2017 and how you expect that partial solar eclipse to compare to today's solar eclipse?
Sure, yes. So 2017, the partial solar eclipse was awe-inspiring, but there was a lot of other things that went along with it. So it was a very busy day. People were very excited to see this partial eclipse. We can expect, and we already know, that people are really excited about this total solar eclipse coming in a couple days. And leading up to the eclipse, we saw that people really wanted eclipse glasses. And at the end there, right before it, they did get scarce. It was difficult to obtain those glasses. But what we also learned is that people really liked those indirect viewing methods as well. The traditional pinhole viewers, and other ways to project the eclipse onto surfaces like a sidewalk or a driveway. And that information, we have some of that on the Buffalo Museum of Science's website, sciencebuff.org. And those are great for all individuals, small children especially, who may not be able to wear glasses easily or keep them on easily. And during that partial solar eclipse, we also saw that people really liked experiencing that whole event with all their senses, you know, the light reduction, the change in temperature, and we can expect that to be even greater this time.
Well, that's part of the wonderment of eclipses, isn't it, that we learn so much from them? So what kind of scientific data actually comes out of an eclipse?
There is a number of different kind of types of data that can come out of eclipses, depending on what you're interested in. So there are a lot of research projects focusing on how, say, animals react to the eclipse. And a lot of those projects are citizen science projects. Having so many people across the country and the world being able to add their data from a number of different locations really adds to, you know, a project like that. And there's projects collecting data on how clouds react, how the ground temperature reacts during an eclipse. Again, any kind of data that you could collect, the scientists are collecting it.
And how do they use this data?
Again, it depends on what their research question is. So there was just a research paper that came out looking at how, like I said earlier, how clouds react to an eclipse. So they can help with future eclipses, understanding, you know, the weather patterns and predicting what the weather would be like during an eclipse. So the data that they're using have come from previous eclipses. So their research states that during an eclipse, clouds are likely to dissipate during as the temperature drops and the eclipse goes forward. Their data shows that clouds are more likely to dissipate and have clearer skies. Again, that's not all the time, but that's what the data shows currently.
And this data that's collected during an eclipse is not just used to understand eclipses better, but also our world, our senses, and so forth. So I understand that there's been a number of discoveries that come out of this kind of data. Help us understand that.
So yeah, that goes all, that can go back, you know, hundreds of years where, for example, the sun's corona was only visible before, you know, modern technology during a solar eclipse. And so during that time, scientists studied that data to understand the sun and the sun's outer atmosphere. That's an old example, but currently, again, during eclipses, you can, scientists can study how, you know, as the sun is covered by the moon, how these different natural phenomena react, whether, again, it's animals or surface temperatures. And they use that, again, for prediction of weather patterns through all types of conditions, weather or, you know, natural conditions.
What are your actual plans for the eclipse?
Well, my plan is the museum staff will be out at a number of different media locations and helping people understand what's happening, making sure they're having a safe, enjoyable experience. And so we will be out there in the media doing that. So that's my plan for the day.
And particularly for folks who are blind or have other visual impairments, any advice for experiencing this eclipse?
Yeah, so there are going to be other senses that we can use during the eclipse. We will, even if it's cloudy here, we will still feel a temperature drop during the totality and during the eclipse. Along with that, there could potentially be changes in things like wind patterns associated with that temperature drop. We can hear animals as they react to it. We know from other eclipses that birds tend to get very quiet at totality, and then when light starts to appear again, they start their dawn chorus. We can use our other senses besides just vision to experience this eclipse.
Anything else that we didn't talk about that you'd like to talk about?
What we love about this eclipse is that we can experience it all over Western New York. You don't have to be anywhere special. You can, with the right safety precautions, we can all experience this and experience a very unique celestial event.
Thank you, Dr. Shriver. Dr. Holly Shriver is Chief Scientist at the Buffalo Science Museum and TIFF Nature Preserve.
You've been listening to special programming created by the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service on the 2024 Total Solar Eclipse. I'm Marion Heatherly, Radio Reading's Community Engagement Coordinator. Thank you for joining us.